Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, April the 30th, last day of April. One-third of 2017 is behind us, so we can finally stop talking about the 100 days of Trump and maybe get into a little bit more serious coverage from the media. Maybe I'm just a wishful thinker. I don't know. As we like to do on Sundays, we'll be talking with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Virgin Agenda. We've got a lot to get into today, as we always seem to on Sundays when we chat with Bill. We'll talk about North Korea. Bill has a very interesting post at Urgent Agenda about some of our commanders saying that we're running out of munitions. That's pretty scary, isn't it, for a country as big as this one, that we're running out of munitions? That's something to think about. The GOP and Obamacare, apparently it's going to happen this week. Well, we certainly hope it does. Another interesting story that Bill had this week was about polling data. Now, this is an article that I think it was in Politico, where they were interviewing Mark Penn, and he said that the polls may be underestimating Trump's support again. You know, they did in 2016, and Mark Penn feels like it may be happening again in 2017. The media is also facing its own difficulties. The bad news for the media is they don't seem to have a lot of credibility with the American people. Texas has been in the news quite a bit lately because of our battle against sanctuary cities. The state of Texas is taking a very strong position about this, and I completely support it. This is not about immigration. This is about the rule of law. And I'm really very happy that Governor Abbott is taking a very tough position on this. Interesting story in Colorado, where the Democrat governor has taken a position supporting free speech. Now, I emphasize Democrat governor because we may be looking here at a man who may be looking for president, who may be positioning himself to the right of where the Democrat Party is right now. And then, of course, in Wisconsin, there's also a story that the legislature may be taking a tough position defending free speech in the universities. Fascinating story that I read today about the Democrats and the labor union. Not the kind of relationship, I think, that we've grown accustomed to. There's a little tension there between the Democrats and the labor unions. And President Trump last night decided to go around the media and have his own show. I think it was up in Pennsylvania. So a lot of stuff to talk about. Let's say hello to our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, it's beautiful here in North Texas. A little windy, but otherwise beautiful.
Well, it is pretty good, nice here, too, Silvio. A little colder than I had thought. I went out before to fix up some scratches on my car, which had been imposed on me, I think, by a liberal parked next to me in a parking space. And I was very surprised at how cold it was, but pleasant otherwise. As far as the political weather here, it's as stormy as it has been. It's you know, you mentioned these things in the introduction. I remember back, and I'm old enough to remember back quite well, the 1960s, the late 60s. And it strikes me that we are going through a period rather similar to that. I remember the same kind of craziness on the left then that we have today. I recall gathering around a piano at the home of a fairly well-known a composer, because he had just written a song called It Can't Happen Here about the coming of fascism to America and how we were losing our freedoms and how Vietnam was corrupting us. And just a few hours earlier, they had all been at this huge anti-war rally in Central Park in which they were exercising freedom of speech the likes of which we'd never seen before. No other country in the world would allow a rally like that in wartime, and the Vietnam War was on, except the United States. And they were saying, we're plunging into fascism. We have very much the same thing today. And I get the feeling a lot of the people who are out there today in these demonstrations that we see are the children and grandchildren of the 60s generation. And what is remarkable about it is that, once again, it is the left that is threatening our freedoms, not the right. I mean, we have no real threats from the right. It is from the left on American college campuses. We remember how the left disposed of ROTC in wartime on American college campuses, how people were shouted down, how teachings were one-sided. And, gee, am I reliving history?
I think you are. Speaking of reliving history, just a quick note that it was this week in 1975 that Vietnam fell, South Vietnam,
yes.
That is, fell to the communists. So when you brought up Vietnam, it just reminded me of that, that we, you know, that was not a good week for freedom this week in 1975. And none of those people who were marching talking about, you know, the horrors of war and how terrible it was, none of them were marching when the communists committed all the atrocities they did in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos.
That's
much
right.
of that went unnoticed. And there were lots and lots of atrocities that were done in those countries after we left. So, yeah, sometimes history repeats itself, Bill. It's crazy how it goes. But North Korea, I kind of like to begin with that, because it seems like North Korea, one day we're ready to go to war, the next day we're not. And I hope we don't go to war, really. I'm not suggesting that we should go to war. But I just saw an interview with President Trump. It looks to me like he's really working on China to fix North Korea. That's what it looks like to me, Bill. How does it look to you?
I think he is, and he seems to feel that he's getting some results. He's a shrewd operator, Trump. He's, you know, I think even some liberals are beginning to concede he's a lot smarter than they thought he was. He obviously wants to solve the problem, which is not the kind of thing that was done by the last administration, which never seemed to solve anything. He just kind of kicked it down the road and made nice statements about negotiations and give peace a chance and all that stuff. I think he wants to solve it. He wants to end their missile and nuclear programs, or at least freeze them. And he understands that one way to do it is putting pressure on China. Another thing to do it is to build our alliances in Asia. Now, he's made a controversial decision, as you know, to invite the president of the Philippines, who was a really bad piece of work, to a conference at the White House. And, you know, there are going to be the usual uproars. Why are you meeting with this man? After all, he's not, you know, a pure Democrat. The same criticisms he received when he met the president of Egypt. But the reality is he needs the Philippines as one of our allies in the Pacific to confront China, to confront North Korea. And I think that is why he's inviting him. I mean, he's a very, very skillful negotiator. And I think if anyone can solve this problem, I think it's Trump. It's going to be very difficult. The North Korean government is really a bad piece of work. It really is. But
yes.
The fact of the matter is we've dealt with governments like that before.
Right. No, you're right. Now, one thing about the president of the Philippines, who is, who is at times almost like a comical figure. I mean, some of the things that he says, he's not very politically correct. And that's one of the reasons I think that a lot of the Western media doesn't like him, because he's taken some very traditional positions on abortion and same-sex marriage. And I think that's a lot of the reason why a lot of the international left doesn't like him. I mean, not I don't necessarily like him, but I'm just saying I think his positions on many of these social issues is what a lot of people don't like. But, Bill, I mentioned this is the end of the 100 days, and everybody seems to have an opinion about President Trump's 100 days. And I found I sent you a copy of this article. Douglas Schoen, who is a serious Democrat, one of the few left, gave President Trump a very interesting grade, and he gave him his highest grades on foreign policy. Actually,
yes.
Gave him an A on foreign policy for being tough. And that's good to see that there is a serious Democrat out there who understands just how weak the Obama administration had been on foreign policy bill.
Well, absolutely. And yes, Doug Schoen is a very serious man, a very serious Democrat, as you say. I get the feeling sometimes that he may be a former Democrat by the time all this is over. And there are some others who have spoken out about, you know, the deterioration of the Democratic Party and the fact that Trump is not to be underestimated. I was not a Trump supporter, as you know, but I cannot deny that in his first months, despite some missteps, he has proved himself to be, first of all, a very serious president, and two, a man willing to appoint outstanding people around him, not simply, acolytes and yes men, but vigorous, independent thinkers. I mean, his national security team is about the best I've seen. And Rex Tillerson is turning out to be a terrific Secretary of State and a very active Secretary of State. I mean, again, a very quick study, man with international business experience. And I think that the world is beginning to once again take America seriously. Now, it's been pointed out in some press reports that around the world, among the populations, the ordinary people, Bush is intensely disliked. Trump is intensely disliked. And, of course, the reason for that is the left-wing press of those countries. But I'm not that concerned about the populations. I'm concerned about the governments and how they react to us. Because we recall how the populations around the world loved Obama at the same time that Obama's foreign policy was collapsing. But I think governments are taking the United States much more seriously. One has to be impressed by the sheer number of heads of state who have visited the president during his first 100 days in office. I don't recall anything quite like that. And he seems to get along with them. He seems to speak honestly with them. And I think we're seeing a newfound respect for the United States.
Right. And one of the heads of state who was just here a few days ago was one of the best things to have happened in Latin America in quite some time, and that's President Macri of Argentina, who
yes.
is really a good guy. I mean, he's a very good center-right leader that I hope, we have something that we have something in common with him in terms of trade. I'm sure we do, where we can help Argentina, because that, you know, that's the kind of leader that we need in Latin America, really in the third world to speak of. Now, one item related to foreign policy or free trade is NAFTA, where the president, I thought he was just a master on this bill. First of all, he says that, I don't think he ever actually said he was going to cancel it, but, or maybe he did, I don't know. But then all of a sudden he said, well, after they gave me a call, I decided to reconsider my position. And it just, I mean, he seems to be the master at doing things like these. I mean, he basically says, well, you know, I got a call from my good friend, the president of Mexico, and my good friend, the prime minister of Canada, and they want me to, you know, they don't want me to cancel it. They want me to renegotiate it. I mean, I thought that was a masterful move, Bill.
Yes. Well, and of course, the press criticized him because they said, well, he's changing his mind again. No, what he's doing is negotiating. I mean, and you know, it's a remarkable thing about the press. The press seems to think that Donald Trump's first obligation is to talk to them. His first obligation is to be president of the United States. I wish somebody would remind some of these journalists of that basic fact. You know, when you take the oath of office to be president of the United States, there's no section in there that says, and you will talk to the press every day. The press is kind of like a bunch of babies. Unless you give them complete attention, they start whining and crying. His comments about NAFTA were perfectly in line with what any good negotiator would do. He has suggested and put out a fairly stark map of what could happen if we do not get some cooperation on NAFTA. We did get some cooperation on NAFTA. And because of that, he pulled back a little bit. That's what good negotiators do. It's a risk-reward situation. He is always on the brink of pulling out of a negotiation, which, again, is what good negotiators do. But at the same time, if he sees progress, and I think he actually articulated this in a discussion about China, that he had always called China, during the course of the campaign, currency manipulators. But then when they began to cooperate on North Korea, he pulled that back a little bit. That doesn't mean they're not currency manipulators, but good negotiators know one thing at a time, make some progress, give some reward to your opponent, and then go on and negotiate further. He really is a very, very sophisticated man.
Well, something else, too, that I think other countries are picking up on, and that is that he will walk away from a deal. And I think if you compare that, for example, to the Iran deal, if you compare that to, let's say, the Cuba deal and other things that were done under President Obama, I think the other side knew that President Obama was never going to walk away, that they could basically just, you know, ask for this and ask for that. And they were never, that President Obama seemed so eager to make the deal that he would never walk away. And I think these other countries, you know, certainly Mexico and Canada, clearly feel that he will walk away and blow up the deal if we don't work with him. And I think you're right. I think this is the excellent negotiating tactic. I wanted to take a few minutes, Bill, and talk about, let's get back to the media for a second, because I thought last night he did something once again that was really impressive. He left the reporters back in Washington and were doing, you know, in this, I guess, dinner that they were having, and he goes out and he talks to people. Now, I thought that was – I didn't watch either one, but just from the little I could see of it, it seems to me that he got the best deal out of this, because you have these reporters back in Washington basically talking to each other about how indispensable they are, and then you have Trump, you know, talking to actual voters. And at one point, I thought one of the funniest things that came out of the press dinner was one of the reporters was blasting – or one of the speakers, I guess, was blasting President Trump for this, for this, for this. You know, we're not fake news. But then he had to admit that access, press access during the Trump administration has actually been pretty good. So, I mean, Trump is not really all that bad if he gives you access, something that President Obama didn't do, Bill.
No, President Obama really was not very good in terms of dealing with the press and providing accurate information, which doesn't seem to be very important to some of these boys. I mean, when we remember the legend of the great Susan Rice, who came out rather regularly during the Obama administration with her latest novel, Foreign Policy, and made one statement after another that has proved to be quite inaccurate, I think that there is actually better access. I think it's access to more accurate information these days. And you're quite right that I was watching last night and also reading the reports on both President Trump and the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Trump clearly got the better part of it because he was not at the dinner. The dinner didn't get, first of all, anywhere near as much attention as it normally does when the president attends. And what they should have done, if the reporters in Washington, was to have a fun evening. Just have a fun evening. Instead, as usual, they got up, as you pointed out, and in their little tuxedos, which they rent once a year, to make these pompous statements about the importance of the press. And they had Woodward and Bernstein, who were kind of dragged out, you know, as the symbols of a courageous press, and spoke back to the president. And they had a comedian who naturally was a Muslim. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I thought it was so heavy-handed, the way the press usually does things. The press takes itself so seriously. Whereas President Trump was out on the campaign trail, speaking to his people, getting cheers, ridiculing the press, driving them crazy, and he sounded like a much more powerful and assertive figure than they sounded. Now, he is armed with a recent survey, as you know, that showed that the word of this White House is taken more seriously by the American people than the word of the press. So he knows he's winning, that in any battle with the press, he will probably come out ahead. And the press hasn't gotten that yet. It really hasn't gotten that.
Yeah, no, not at all. Bill, let me take a little break, Bill. When we come back, I want to continue talking about the topic of the media, because I think that is really interesting how much more credible President Trump is than the media. We'll be right back. is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Welcome to our second segment with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Just as we were finishing our last segment, Bill brought up some new information about the credibility of the media. Bill, I think Mr. Trump has to know that, because when he went out there last night, he looked, and like you, I was not a supporter of Donald Trump in the primaries, but I've seen him grow a little bit on the job, and he's really irritating the media. And one of the things I thought he did yesterday, I mean, he looked happy. He looked like he was back in the campaign, and these reporters back at this dinner were all like, almost like, gee, you know, we have to be here tonight. I guess we, you know, we have to be here and put on these tuxedos and be. They didn't look that happy to me compared to how happy President Trump looked last night, Bill.
That's exactly right. And the saga of the media in this administration is going to be something I think that's going to be taken into consideration by historians. And you've heard it said many times, as have I, the media is completely out of touch with the people. The Democratic Party is more than out of touch. I don't think it knows any people. I don't think they've met a citizen in years. But the press seems completely out of touch. They this is not something that's all that unusual. You know, a lot of the press is stationed in Washington. They're part of that echo chamber in Washington or in places like New York. The television journalists are, also perhaps in California. But we don't have the kind of people's journalists that we had at one time. You know, in World War II, there was a very famous reporter named Ernie Pyle who knew how to speak to the individual soldier. And he became revered. He tragically was killed in the last weeks of the war. But well, that's what we need today. You remember perhaps that CBS used to have a reporter, now deceased, named Charles Kuralt, who went around the country in a series called On the Road. And he would just go from town to town talking to people. And he got a sense of what America was. And I'm afraid that some of the reporters we have today only talk to each other and to people with PhDs and to people who participate in demonstrations in Washington with funny hats on. And that's their world. And I once interviewed Charles Kuralt, by the way, the CBS reporter, and I said, Charles, of all the things you've learned in going around the United States all these years, what is the most important? And without any hesitation, he said, I'm always amazed at how well-informed Americans are. And he was right. Americans are far more aware of what's going on than many people in the press and in the universities think. They may not be able to articulate it the way a college professor would, but they feel it. And people should go out and talk to them.
Well, something else, too, Bill, that I think speaks volumes about the media. There is probably very few members of the media who were sitting there last night who have served in the military and or who maybe went to a school, you know, let's say in the middle of the country or something, or who share conservative values. And I think that isolates them from the rest of the country, but particularly the military service, because I think when you serve in the military, you have a perspective on the country and what the country stands for than when you don't. I really believe that. And so I think a lot of these reporters, they're not members of the military. I don't think most of them can relate to union people, to military people. And I think that's the reason why they are so isolated. And then every time they bring up free speech, you know, they got to drag out Woodward and Bernstein, who've become like the two, I guess, the two angels of the media. And, you know, it's like that's all they can do is talk about Watergate and how they saved us from Nixon. I mean, it seems like that's the only thing they can go back to.
Yes, I remember. I do remember Watergate, of course. I mean, the greatest constitutional crisis in our history. I mean, I remember people thought the country is on the brink of losing everything. I mean, it was a $2 burglary by some stupid operatives, or led by some dummies at the Republican National Committee. It was handled horribly by Nixon, who actually was in many respects a very capable man, but he had that side to him, which was, I can't explain it. I'm not a psychiatrist, where he wanted to cover everything up. If Richard Nixon at Watergate had simply come out and said, this occurred, it occurred on my watch, I am responsible for it, this will never happen again, I am putting in the following safeguards at the Republican National Committee, he would have been a national hero. But he made mistakes, and so we Watergate has come down to us as this legendary crisis, this legendary excursion into the depths. My God, things like that were done all the time in politics. But Nixon was particularly disliked by the press, so they went after him, and as I said, he handled it badly. But, yes, they trotted out Woodward and Bernstein. I wasn't surprised to see Bernstein last night come out. I was a little surprised at Woodward, who has been pretty even-handed in his handling of Washington since the Watergate days. Bernstein's an old leftist, though. He's gone forever. But what strikes one is the fact that not one person got up and said, you know, there are a lot of areas in which Trump is right about us. I think some may know it, some may feel it. I think some observers of the press may know it. But I would like to see on the part of the press some modesty, some understanding that they botched the election reporting, that they may have botched a lot of other big stories like the Vietnam War, which I think they did. You know, there was an episode in the press this week that was quite interesting that we should mention, and that was the New York Times, a newspaper that I think is really tottering on the verge of hell, hired for its editorial page one Bret Stephens. For people who don't know who Bret Stephens is, Bret Stephens was on the Wall Street Journal, won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary, had previously been editor of the Jerusalem Post. He was everything a New York Times columnist wasn't. And the Times apparently felt, correctly, they needed a true conservative on their editorial page for balance. They hired him. His first column was one of the most thoughtful that I've read about climate change and about how we should welcome a thorough discussion about climate change. Now, Bret Stephens had been anti-Trump, and I think probably still is. He was a very severe critic of Trump. And after the column ran, he commented that when he was anti-Trump at the Wall Street Journal, he got a lot of abusive mail from Trump supporters. But he said that nothing compared to what happened after he wrote his first column for the Times. The avalanche of hate and the number of subscriptions that were canceled. How dare you run somebody who disagrees with us? I mean, how dare you have this man in your employ? And that is something that I think journalists are going to have to confront, that they have created to a certain degree a class out there of really crazy people. And these people are having an inordinate effect on the operations of the Democratic Party, and I'm afraid to say the operations of part of the press, and it's something we should be
right.
aware of.
Absolutely, and that was a very thoughtful column. I read it a couple of times. I thought it was one of the best columns I've ever read. I mean, he was not saying, Bill, this is what I find so interesting about the reaction. He was not saying that climate change does not exist, or that, I mean, he was basically saying, let's have a conversation. Let's make sure that we really know what's going on. And then he used, I thought in a very clever way, he used the Clinton campaign as an example of what happens when people don't challenge their assumptions. I mean, everybody
That's
at the
right.
Clinton campaign thought they were going to win. And they were all sitting around at 6 o'clock on election night, you know, getting ready to go to the big celebration. And then, of course, it didn't happen. And then, you know, they had to come up with excuses like we've seen. But to me, I thought it was an extremely thoughtful article or column. I read it a couple of times and even shared it with a few friends and said, this is really interesting. Because what he said about global warming and climate change, Bill, we've said it many times on the show. I'm not necessarily in favor or against global warming or climate change. I just want to have a discussion where I'm not called some kind of a crazy person because I challenge some of the assumptions. That's all he was saying. I thought it was very good. And if liberals don't like it, well, that says more about them than it does about Stevens, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. I was interested in it in part because Charles Krauthammer, of course, great conservative columnist, takes the same position on climate change. He said, I'm neither a denier or an acceptor or a proponent. He said, I want to see more information. And you know what very often is not discussed when climate change is discussed is the fact that this is not just a theoretical discussion. The climate change people have asked for trillions of dollars to be spent on this issue, trillions of dollars that could be devoted to health programs, to education programs, to other things that nations need, infrastructure building, and it's being taken away from other things on the basis of what really amounts to a theory. And people are saying, give us more information. Let us see more proof. And there was something last week on television that was absolutely astounding. CNN had on Bill Nye, the science guy. Everyone knows Bill Nye, the science guy, who really was a creation of Disney. I mean, he's not a science guy. He does have a degree in engineering, but he is basically an entertainer who talks about science. And opposing him was a Princeton professor. And Nye gets up on television and says to CNN, whose air he was using, I think you've done a great disservice by having this man on the air to debate me. Now, why don't you have just on another person who represents the real consensus of climate scientists? I mean, who does this man think he is? You know, it was for the first time in a long time I saw an actual discussion about the subject, but the idea that no one is allowed to disagree. Stevens in his column said something very wise, quoting someone else, that people, when you see people who claim certitude, you're in a lot of trouble. And the certitude must always be rejected because that's not what science is about. Science is not about something being settled. It's about the investigation. I thought this episode was very telling and told us also there is a tremendous amount of immaturity out there that seems to be a growing problem in America. You know, the word crisis is overused, but if there is a crisis in America today, it's a maturity crisis, and I think it's beginning to hurt the country.
Well, and, you know, this thing with climate change and with global warming, it gets to a point where it's silly. I was talking to a friend of mine from South America. I have not spoken to him for a long time. And, you know, I asked him, how's the weather? I did the usual small talk, you know, how's the weather? And he says, well, since global warming, we've had this increase in tornadoes down here. And yes. I said jokingly, what do you mean since global warming? Well, don't you know, everybody knows that the Earth is warmer? I didn't want to get into a debate because, you know, what's the point? But you hear this all the time from people who will tell you, well, that's because of global warming. That's because of global warming. And it may be, I don't know, 100 years from now, it may all turn out to be true. But it could turn out to be wrong. So why shouldn't we learn a little bit more, especially, as you say, Bill, if they're asking us to write these big checks? I mean, yes. I want to know what the heck they're going to do with all that money. And we've had already instances where they have, you know, they've messed up some of the information just to make their point. So, you know, I'm skeptical, not against them, but I'm just my old natural skeptical. If you're asking me for a ton of money, I want to know a little bit more about what you're going to do with all that money or what you're basing your theory on, Bill.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's interesting. When I was a student at the University of Chicago, I took a class a kind of class for science for non-scientists. And we learned and studied a lot of theories over the centuries of scientists that had been accepted for a time and turned out to be wrong. And I asked the professor, why are we learning all these wrong theories? And he said, we want you to understand how science proceeds. Science proceeds with very great difficulty. Science is not easy. It is very hard. That's why the best students in the class are usually the scientists. And there have been a number of cases in the history of science of things that scientists have believed and seriously believed and turned out to be wrong in the end. And we have to recognize that. There should be more teaching about science and about the history of science and saying, wait a minute, let's understand more about this before we, as you said, write those checks. Because those checks cannot be taken. Those checks cannot be taken back.
That's right. And you know, it's interesting. A few months ago, I think it must have been at Thanksgiving or around that time, we were having dinner, and it was an opportunity to get together as a family. And I was talking to my sons, and I kind of mentioned something about being skeptical about climate change, not necessarily rejecting it, but just having some skepticism. And one of my sons, looked at me and said, well, why do you feel that way? And I said, well, look, in my lifetime, I said to them, I sold two covers of Time magazine, one that said global warming and one that said global cooling, meaning one time the magazine was telling us that the world was going to freeze, and the other time they were telling us the world was going to melt, and this has happened, Bill, in the last 30 years. So
if you can have Newsweek,
and I'm sitting there saying, you know, if you can have that kind of change where, you know, one one cover we're melting and in the other cover we're freezing, I'm going to step back a little bit and say, hey, folks, I need more information, because those are contradictory results, Bill.
Of course. And, you know, this I've seen some commentators who held up those covers on television discussions. You know, the world is going to hell, or the world is going to freeze, and it's this is true and that's true. And all you have to do is look back on our own lives and look at the changes that have been made in our lives by medical science in prescribing what one should do about heart disease. You know, at one time, if you had a heart attack, God forbid, you were put to bed for 6 weeks. You were told that you could not live a normal life any longer. You had to rest constantly and this and that. Now people have heart attacks. They're told to get up out of bed after 2 days, walk around, do some exercise after time. It's a completely different regimen. And that is what happens when science advances. It changes. And things that were believed to be true turn out perhaps to be not true, or to be only partially true, or there may be some other factor that hadn't been taken into consideration. That's one of the exciting things about science, is that the results are ever-changing. And one of the things I also worry about in the reporting of climate change and whatever it's going to be called next year, the label seems to change rather regularly, as regularly as the climate, is the impact of money. And that is the impact of grants. To get a grant in the climate area today, especially from the federal government, you almost have to be a believer. I don't think a dissenter can get a federal grant. And President Eisenhower, in his farewell address, the famous industrial military complex speech, mentioned this. He warned about the impact of federal funds on scientific results. It reflected his wisdom and the fact that he was prescient about this. But I wonder how much of what we are being told about climate change is driven by economics, by money, by people trying to enrich themselves by latching onto a cause, or trying to develop a product that they want to sell. I think it's something worth investigating.
That's right. Well, it could also be people who just want to hold on to their jobs. I mean, some of these college professors or people in universities who may not be looking to get rich, they just want to hold on to their jobs because their jobs are related to these grants. Bill, I wanted to go to the Democrats again, because there's a very interesting piece, a very interesting article that came out this morning, or I saw it this morning, about the president of the labor union. I think his last name is Mr. Trumka, who was being interviewed.
Yeah.
Yes, and he was not very happy with the Democrats. I mean, he was saying that, you know, the interviewer asked him a question, but what about the Clinton economy? Didn't we get 20 million jobs? And he said, yeah, but they weren't really well-paying jobs. And then he talked about President Obama. Yeah, you know, he has a heart of gold, but, you know, and so on and so on. I mean, there seems to be a dissatisfaction, and I think he was kind of sending a message to the Democrat Party that we're not just going to vote for you like this anymore. And I think part of this, Bill, I'd like to get your reaction to this, but part of this is that President Trump, this is a underreported story, but he's actually making gains with the union people. I mean, when many of these union Democrats, and that's what they used to be, Democrats, or probably still are, I mean, they turn on the television and they hear the Democratic Party invested in sanctuary cities, and then they have President Trump talking about globalization killing your job. Well, who do you think they're going to support, Bill? They're going to go they're going to go with President Trump. I also think that many of these Democrats just don't relate to these union Democrats. I mean, to these union workers anymore. I mean, if one of these guys like Tom Perez goes to a union hall, you think he's going to relate to these guys? I don't think so. So that's a real problem the Democrats have. It's a bit underreported, but I think it's a serious problem, Bill.
It's a very serious problem, and I think you're hearing it more and more. Even Democratic office holders are saying the Democratic Party just can't be against things. It has to be for something. And maybe we're not hearing much of that because a lot of the people in the Democratic Party are frightened to say what they're for because it will be rejected by the public, or it'll be rejected by their fellow Democrats. The hatreds within the Democratic Party are enormous. It was interesting that you mentioned Tom Perez, who was the Secretary of Labor in the Obama administration, and before that was head of one of the divisions of the Justice Department. He was considered one of the most extreme members of the Obama administration. And when he was made party chairman, I thought to myself, my God, this is exactly what you don't want in a party chairman, a kind of political extremist with no real experience at organizing a political party. And sure enough, he goes out on the stump to talk to people and starts cursing, starts using foul language. That's something you... Why? What do you gain by that? Now, I read an interesting column this week, I wish I could remember who wrote it, who said that this is now a thing among Democrats, that you curse. Kirsten Gillibrand was our senator from New York, who is probably one of the worst members of the U.S. Senate, also, in a recent interview, used foul language in answering questions that apparently to appeal to the young generation, they feel that this is necessary. We have to talk in their terms. Well, Mario Cuomo once said it best. He said, you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. But when you campaign in poetry, you don't use a language that's bound to offend people. And then Perez said something to the effect that, well, only people who favor abortion rights are welcome in the Democratic Party. Now, he immediately corrected it, or tried to correct it. He botched the correction. But my goodness, the purpose of a party chairman is not to drive people out of the party. It's to welcome people into the party. And I think, yes, the party is in a lot of trouble. It was also interesting that his co-chairman, Keith Ellison, who you talk about a man with a radical past, he was at one time a member of the Nation of Islam, and he actually said publicly that the Democratic Party was badly damaged by Barack Obama. It didn't get much publicity, but that's an extraordinary statement to make for a Democratic national chairman. The party is in terrible shape. The Republican Party isn't in such great shape either, and it would be nice if they actually did something in Congress.
That's right.
But the Democratic Party is in horrendous shape. Now, they may win a seat in Georgia in the next week or so, that seat that's open to Tom Price evacuated to become a member of the cabinet, and they'll all start cheering and saying, this is great, this is great, this is great. No, it's not. They're not particularly popular. The polling shows that the Republican Party, while also not popular, is not as unpopular as the Democratic Party. You look at the bench on the Democratic Party, who could they run in 2020? And after all, 2020 is only 3 years away, and the election campaign for the president will begin in a year and a half. Who do they run? I mean, they really do not have any obvious candidates for president because so many Democrats make fools of themselves.
Right. And speaking of that, we're going to take a little break, but when we come back, I want to talk about the governor of Colorado because he may be one who's preparing the table to run because of something that he did in Colorado. We'll be right back. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Let's do another segment here with our good friend Bill Katz. We were just talking about the Democrats, Bill, and something very interesting you wrote about this week happening in Colorado, where the Democrat governor of that state has taken a position defending free speech at the university. And this may be a sign. I mean, I may be overanalyzing this, But this, you know, this is apparently a popular governor. He represents an important state, of course, Colorado, and a state that I think went for, I'm pretty sure that it went for Mr. Trump the last time around. But this is, I think, maybe a sign that there's a Democrat out there who's beginning to realize that, you know, he has to move in a different direction if he wants to win the election, and he's fighting for free speech. They're doing the same thing in Wisconsin, where the legislature, as you wrote today, is also taking a position on this. I think this is about time, and if there was a Democrat out there who could actually, you know, see the writing on the wall, he might be a serious candidate in 2020. There isn't any right now. I don't think it'll be Elizabeth Warren as a serious candidate. Bernie Sanders is not a serious candidate. Michelle Obama is not a serious candidate. But if you had a governor like this, that might work, Bill.
It might. And yet, when we look at the field and look at what a candidate on the Democratic side will be facing, that candidate will be facing a party whose internal mechanism is under the control of the Bernie Sanders wing. And you have to get the nomination first. And the base of the Democratic Party really right now is, it resembles a group of patients in a psychiatric office. I mean, it has gone really nuts. Now, there have been times in history when the Republican Party has had that problem. And the Republicans seem to be better at taking care of it than the Democrats. You know, we remember back in the 1950s when Joe McCarthy was around and was really distorting the Republican Party. It was Republicans who brought him down and who corrected the party. It was not Democrats. Democrats, when their party starts to go astray, have a very difficult time correcting it, because the people who lead the way out of sanity tend to be very vociferous, very militant, and in some cases frightening. The last Democrat who was able to really correct the party, even if only for a time, was Bill Clinton. And he, in a way, saved the Democratic Party from itself. And when Obama ran in 2008, he had the shrewdness to run as a kind of practical guy, which he wasn't, and it was proved over a period of years that he wasn't. He was actually a leftist in disguise, and the disguise became very thin during his administration. But the party has got to be corrected, and you're not going to correct a party by having a man like Tom Perez as the national chairman. They need the un-Tom Perez. They need professional operators who know how to build a professional party.
Right. Well, I understand that when Tom Perez made one of those speeches with profanity, that there were children on the stage, which is even more shocking but I also understand, Bill, that Nancy Pelosi may be facing a primary challenge, which I think would be the ultimate comedy if she faces a primary challenge from the left. She may decide to retire if that really happens, Bill.
Well, Nancy Pelosi is becoming elderly, and she is making some public appearances that have become embarrassing. If she faces a primary challenge, you'll have to first tell Nancy there's an election, and then maybe she'll, you know, respond. But she tends to lose her place. I think she is reaching the point now where it would be better for her to graciously step aside. But her district is a very liberal district, as you pointed out. She's facing a primary challenge from the left. And my fear is that whoever replaces her will actually be worse, not better. There have to be people in the Democratic Party, as you pointed out, who know what's wrong, who know what is happening. I have to believe that Chuck Schumer here in New York, who's the minority leader of the Senate and is known as a very smart man, must understand what is going wrong. He's going along with it. He has to go along with it for self-preservation. But there's a point where this kind of radicalism will consume a political party. And I think that next year, in 2018, history is on the Democrat side in terms of what the midterm election results should look like, because generally the party in power in the White House loses seats. But the Democratic Party has a number of vulnerable seats that are up for grabs in the United States Senate next year, and history may not repeat itself.
Right. No, because you're exactly right. They have so many wackos in that party that it's absolutely frightening. And one of those examples of wackiness, Bill, is happening right here in Texas with the sanctuary cities. I was on Telemundo. It was recorded on Friday, and I guess it's going to be shown today. But one of the things that I mentioned about the sanctuary cities was I said it has nothing to do with immigration. This is about the rule of law. And I said I'm very disappointed that this has become a party issue in Texas, where all the Democrats voted one way and all the Republicans voted the other way. How is it possible that the Democrats are that tone deaf, I said, when you have an issue where 80% of the citizens are opposed to sanctuary cities, and yet the Democrats are going to go down with the ship, as they say, just like they did with Gorsuch. This is a party that seriously needs an adult. I don't know how else to say it. I hate to offend any Democrat who's listening, but if they're serious, I think they would agree with me. This is a party that really needs an adult, Bill.
It does, and it needs the kind of leadership that can reassert fundamental principles. You know, in this recent series of events we've seen on college campuses, where speakers have been shouted down, including the barring of Ann Coulter from speaking at Berkeley, even Bernie Sanders said, "Look, this is ridiculous. People have a right to speak." So even Sanders is coming to his senses, and I think is beginning to realize this is becoming frightening. There should be immediate denunciations on the part of the Democratic Party of any attempt to suppress free speech. They should become they at one time were the free speech party. They were the party of liberalism. They were the party of rejection of McCarthyism. And look what they've become today. They have become the new McCarthyites. The McCarthyism we see today is McCarthyism of the left, and yet they won't do a thing about it.
No, you're exactly right. Let's look at next week, Bill, because there's some interest. As always, with the Trump presidency, there's always something going on. I did want to say one quick thing about the Trump presidency and get your reaction to this. I have never seen a presidency with the energy of the Trump presidency, and I'm beginning to worry a little bit about the people around him, because these people are going to be exhausted in a year, year and a half. We may see massive changes, not because there's disagreement, simply because the people are exhausted. I mean, Trump is keeping a pace. I don't recall it, Bill. Maybe you do, but I don't recall anything like it. Going back to Johnson, which is, you know, the one president I recall, Bill.
Yes, and the vigor of the man at the age of 70 is remarkable. I think the people around him will actually do quite well. I think that they kind of enjoy all this activity. But it is amazing to see some of the criticism that he hasn't achieved anything in 100 days. What he has achieved is something that most presidents can only dream about. He's achieved a completely new stance for the United States in foreign policy that is being accepted around the world. And he has been able to achieve the idea accepted by the American people that major change must be made to improve the American economy. He has changed the psychology of the country very dramatically. There was a poll taken, or a survey, I don't know what kind of a poll it was actually, I have to say, of millennials, the young people who were supposed to be so anti-Trump, that demonstrated, oh yes, I think it was the Harvard-Harris survey, that showed that millennials surprisingly support Trump's policies to a very considerable degree. They just don't like him personally. You know, there's that division that we often see when Trump is polled, that people may like his policies, they may not like him that much. But I was very surprised at the level of support for his policies that exists among young people. I think it's going to be a very exciting year in American politics, and I think the president may come out quite well. Unless the press destroys
it.
Yeah, unless
well,
the press destroys
Well, I think
destroys
you're right. Right, and because the press may destroy itself, too, in the process.
Yes.
Because they're burning a lot of bridges themselves. But you know, everybody got hung up on this 100-day thing, and I'm so happy it's finally over. But, you know, let's say, for example, that he gets Obamacare done next week and maybe gets NAFTA renegotiated this year. I mean, that's pretty significant achievements for your first year on top of Gorsuch. I don't think that's anything to feel bad about, Bill. I mean, and then tax reform, it might take a little bit more. But, I mean, I think he's doing a lot of things. But like you say, the media is just talking down and just talking bad about him. But I also think the media is hurting itself. I really do. I think, you know, everywhere I go, I hear that, Bill. And I hear it from people who aren't really that political. We were at a social last night, and people just say, oh, I'm getting tired of the media. All they do is beat up Trump. And that's coming from people who weren't fans of Trump, Bill.
That's right. And you do hear this. I think you hear it from liberals. I think that the polls show it, that clearly there is a feeling that the press has been unfair to Trump. And, you know, if I were in the press today, if I were running CNN, I'd realize there was danger to this. Because an organization like CNN is giving up its credibility. Apparently there was a corporate decision made that we would be the anti-Trump network. And what they say is, well, we're going where the facts take us, or we have to hold him to account. Well, that's very fine if you had held Barack Obama to account. But these are the same organizations that never asked Barack Obama a single serious question. And people know
right.
that. The American people are brighter than the press believes.
I think you're right, and I think a lot of people, you know, I ask myself, where was all this investigative journalism when President Obama was president? You know,
yes.
It seems like they forgot to practice it at most of these networks. Well, Bill, as always, thank you for your time. Look forward to our next time, and keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda. I know that I'm sure I speak for a lot of people who follow you and read you every day and learn a great deal from what you do, Bill. So thank you for the great work that you do and for the time that you give us every Sunday.
Well, thank you, sir. It's a pleasure and an honor, and we'll be back again next week.
All right, let's do it. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Enjoy your evening, Bill.
Thank you. Same to you, Sylvia.
All right. Well, that's going to do it, folks. The time just absolutely flies when we visit with Bill, doesn't it? I mean, it just seems like this clock just runs by. We must be having fun with Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. This is Silvio Canto and Dallas saying goodnight, and we'll talk to you later.